Yeah, there's commitment, confirmation, and counterfeit. You know, people so often try to lead someone into the commitment, yes, through the confirmation, yes. You know, we talk about it in my book. Somebody stops you in the street and says, do you like water? Do you like clean water? Do you get thirsty? These are set up traps. This guy's gone someplace with this. Well, of course I like water. You're setting me up.
I'm excited to introduce our guest today. He is a former international FBI lead hostage negotiator, the CEO of the Black Swan Group, multiple-time TEDx speaker, masterclass teacher, and the co-author of the best-selling book, Never Split the Difference. I am pleased to welcome Chris Voss.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. It's a pleasure.
We're on a mission to explore how emerging technologies, media, robotics, and data and behavioral science will solve humanity's most pressing challenges. From education, mobility, energy, food and water supplies, the environment, employment, all the way to disease and basic human rights. Nothing is off limits. This episode is brought to you by Beverage Universe. They have every flavor to help you stay young, beautiful, and thirsty. Go to beverageuniverse.com for your next flavor experience.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you for letting me interrogate you today. Just to give our audience some insight into your impressive background, you were the lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI. You represented the FBI at multiple National Security Council working groups. You represented the U.S. government at different conferences. You served as the lead crisis negotiator for the New York City Division of the FBI, and you were a member of the New York City Joint Terrorist Task Force for over 14 years, I believe.
Yes.
And I think it was during 9/11 as well. I was actually at Battery Park Plaza when it happened and witnessed the plane. Yeah, it was a very challenging time. So you've also received the Attorney General's Award for Excellence in Law Enforcement and the FBI's Agents Association Award for Distinguished and Exemplary Service. And I cannot say what an honor it is to have you here today. I've read your book, and in your words, it was a reality bender for me and a game changer. And I'm sure it's you know, not just me. There's thousands, hundreds of thousands of business people that, or just people in general, that I think would benefit from learning some of your tactics and picking up some of your advice on how to even just have a relationship with people. Forget about sales, negotiations, business, things like that. Just to have a great collaborative relationship with people. I wish I had found your book 20 years ago, to be honest. It would have made a lot of things easier. So, and I'm going to drop the link for all of these resources in the captions below so that people can find you and they can click through and get to know you a little bit better. But let's talk about your impressive background. How did you get started in a career in hostage negotiation?
I work with New York City cops. I was on a street with New York City cops, and I really enjoyed the city and working with those guys. Great people. I'd been on the SWAT team earlier in my very beginning FBI, and I injured my knee, and we had hostage negotiators, and I thought, well, you know, instead of continuing to injure my knee, maybe I'll do the job board talks. I mean, how hard could talking to terrorists be? I talk all the time. How hard could that be? And it's like anything else that looks easy. You know, there's a lot to it. a lot to it. And I was actually initially rejected. It was a woman in charge of the negotiation team in New York at the time, and she was completely and fully underwhelmed by me. Because I had no experience.
That's hard to believe.
Everybody starts out someplace, right?
That's true.
But I was persistent with her, and she rejected me. And I said, there's got to be something I could do. And she said, there is. Go volunteer on a suicide hotline. And that was a real turning point. I mean, you want to learn about how to get along with people. You know, people in crisis are just, it's just turning up the heat, turning up the temperature. But it's still the same reactions. And that was a phenomenal experience. And that was a game-changing moment for me on my entire negotiation career.
So what does somebody do at a suicide hotline as a volunteer there? Like, what was your job there?
Well, you know, they give you great training. I mean, they give you phenomenal training on empathy, of all things. You know, what I refer to as tactical empathy, we defined it much more in the FBI, and I define it much more in the book. But it wasn't as well defined, but it was the same stuff. And the training was great. They really taught you how to dial into people. And then they tell you when you get ready to get on the line, you won't be on a line with anybody longer than 20 minutes. And I remember thinking, like, what, you got to be kidding me, 20 minutes? That's crazy. I can't order from a restaurant 20 minutes. You know, that's not going to happen. But they're like, no, you know, if you do it right, empathy is an accelerator. Empathy accelerates success. And they were right. I mean, they taught me how to use emotional intelligence. We didn't have that term back then. And you'd be on the line after you went through the training. It was a good solid 80 hours of training, 2 full weeks, you know, 4 hours, the equivalent of 2 weeks of training. And then you volunteer your own 4 hours. At that time, you did it in person. We didn't have call forwarding. You can do it from home these days. But you took 2 4-hour shifts a month, 8 hours on a line. I used to go up in the evenings and do 4 hours, and I would learn, and it was immensely rewarding.
Do you have any experiences during that time that kind of pop into your mind of an example of where you thought you did a great job, but essentially maybe you didn't?
Oh, well, when I came up for a review after I'd been there for a year. I mean, communication skills are perishable skills. Negotiation skills are perishable skills. And it, you know, they deteriorate in a way that you just don't notice. I mean, because you're kind of not really scoring points all the time. And especially communication skills, you'll develop bad habits where the people on the other side tell you, I had a great talk to you. And you did a bad job. And that was exactly what happened when I came up for my 1 year review. I came up for the review, and the caller on the other end of the line literally said, wow, you really helped me. You are fantastic at this. Thanks for how much you helped me. So, you know, the guy supervising me, Jim, he's listening in the other room on another line. I walk into the room. I'm kind of, you know, buffing my fingernails on my shirt because I'm just all puffed out. Figured, you know, I just got congratulated. I felt like if he has any doubt in his mind, you know, the caller just told him I was great. And Jim was a sweetheart of a guy. He sat down. He says, man, that was horrible. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, you were really, your skills have just gone deteriorated really badly. I said, wait a minute. Jim, didn't you hear the guy? He congratulated me on what a great job I did. He said, that's the first indicator of how you screwed it up. He thinks you did a good job, which means he doesn't feel like he did it himself. Which means lost without you. If they tell you you did a good job, they don't feel self-autonomy. They don't feel like they can handle things without you. That's the first sign that you screwed up completely. They have to
be involved.
And I was like, you know, he had me. And I was like, wow. And that was when I'm like, I gotta dive back in. I gotta study the heck out of this and find out what I did wrong. And that was a huge moment for me because it made me appreciate, keep your game up. You got to work on your game.
Very interesting. I mean, I guess that applies to a lot of areas in life in general. You know, when you are trying to lead somebody through something, you want them to become independent at some point so that they can do what they need to do and give them that feeling of security in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. You know, security, autonomy, trust, loyalty. I mean, they're very bonded to you when they feel that way. They don't know it. It's invisible to them. But I mean, it's just, you know, I get coached now. I get coached probably with three different ways because you got to work on your game. And one of the outfits we work with a lot is an outfit called Strategic Coach. Dan Sullivan and his wife Babs run that operation. They're huge. But they talk about, If you run a business well, if I run my business well, my people don't got to talk to me every day. I mean, you know, they feel a lot of autonomy. It's a self-running business. If I'm running everything personally, then I'm doing a lousy job. They don't feel like they could handle it without me. I'm not a good leader.
So you were in the New York City Joint Terrorist Task Force. Like, what did you do there? What are some of the experiences you had? So you came out of the suicide hotline. You went back to the woman that was that rejected you initially for the hostage negotiation career and the job. And then what happened from there?
Well, this task force was a great thing. I mean, a lot of investigative fraud across the FBI these days, because of the success of two task forces. In New York, the bank robbery task force and the terrorist task force, they brought in NYPD. They sat us down, you know, the agents and the cops. We worked together, the detectives. We were complete peers. It was actually kind of interesting because both organizations thought we became too much of the other. You know, the FBI thought we became too much like police detectives. And NYPD thought that detectives became too much like FBI agents. You know, what we really did was we merged into these mutants that were combinations of the two. It was great work. I mean, the cops taught me so much about getting by in New York City. And, you know, we taught them, we brought our resources to the table. We probably learned more from those guys than they learned from us. And, you know, we get honest, we had to run in the city. And we worked our tails off. We worked 24/7. They were good people. We worked really hard, made great cases. And we were in a position, you know, the first attack on a World Trade Center back in 93, we rounded those guys up in like 72 hours because we've been working those cases and we work with great people. So it was a phenomenal time in my career. I worked with some of the best people I've ever met my entire life.
So what was it like at that time? How did you guys identify terrorist organizations or even like domestic terrorism at that particular time? I know it's a little bit different now, I'm sure, but.
Well, it was the end of the first generation of terrorism, if you will, in New York City. There'd been a bunch of domestic terrorist groups organized along ethnic bases, like every ethnic group had a terrorist group, the Cubans, the Omega 7, the anti-Castro people. You know, there were a couple of Jewish groups, JDL. You know, there were people saying they were JDL and they were bombing. There were the Black Panthers and offshoots of the Panthers. There was a group that was made largely of Caucasian lesbians, you know, and they were probably the most organized and the most effective. That was the smartest group of all the different groups. They called themselves the May 19th Communist Organization, and they were the most dangerous, smartest, most organized.
Wow.
Yeah, it was nuts. And most all of them before I got there had been bombing or robbing. The Omega 7 hit the Cuban mission in New York City with pipe bombs 6 months in a row, once a month, six straight months, they hit the Cuban mission. I mean, these were active groups. It was crazy times.
Wow.
I came in on the tail end of that. But the guys that I work with, they learned how to talk to people. I mean, that was why emotional intelligence fit so much in. Hostage negotiation fit in with just talking to people. The way we identified the groups was we were out in the community. We were talking to people. And somebody... What led to a very big case that my partners and I worked on, Terror Stop, these guys approached the security guard for training. And he had a bad feeling, you know. He thought, these guys aren't training to protect themselves. They're training to kidnap somebody. And since we're out in the community talking to people, he'd heard of us and trusted us. We had a great reputation in the community. So he, you know, he approached us. He says, I got a bad feeling about these guys. I think they're going to kidnap and kill an Egyptian. The president of Egypt, as a matter of fact, is who they were after at the time. So we found out about groups because we learned just how to talk to people.
I mean, just listening to you and remembering, because I worked in the city downtown and midtown area, and for a long time, over a decade. And, you know, during 9/11, I was there. During that bombing underneath one of the towers, I was there.
Yeah, wow.
During that full northeast blackout of the electric blackout, I was there.
Wow.
Walked from downtown all the way to Queens, where I lived at the time, multiple times. That was a track that I knew well. So just thinking about all of these things that you're mentioning, I mean, these are some things that I didn't even know, and groups that I didn't even know existed at the time. And I'm sure they've increased in numbers at this point. But I guess just taking the train was a risk back then for civilians. How have some of these, groups evolved? And how does some of what you're saying actually apply to all the stuff that's going on in the news today?
Yeah, well, and what's going on in the news today, I mean, people just want to be heard. The first thing is that people want to be heard. And I remember thinking that essentially was a tool that they gave us to deal with terrorists, especially in kidnappings and hostage takings. Hear them out. And I remember thinking, like, I don't see how that's going to get us anywhere. And it was that way in our suicide hotline. It was that way with negotiating with terrorists. Hear them out. That's going to get you a long way. I mean, literally, one of the kidnappings I worked in the Philippines, you know, we thoroughly heard the kidnapper out on the other side. Now, you know that someone feels thoroughly heard out. And the real issue is not whether or not you understand. The issue is whether or not you make them feel understood. Those are two completely different things. You understanding does not equate to them feeling understood. And when somebody feels understood, what they say is, that's right. So we're working as kidnapping in the Philippines with a terrorist. And he's got all these nonsensical reasons for holding this American, 500 years of oppression. And, you know, you can count on terrorist groups to go back at least 500 years. Believe me, they go back a long time. They're, you know, their list of grievances will go back probably as far as their cause or their religion existed. You know, so this guy in the Philippines is going back 500 years because there's been different colonial powers cruising through the Philippines and exploiting the resources from the Spanish to the Japanese to the Americans. And finally, we just decided to hear this guy out because there's a $10 million ransom demand on the table, which we can't get off the table. We can't even get it lowered. And I tell my guy, we're going to hear him out today. And you'll know that you've heard him out completely. Say everything back to him that he said. That's how you hear somebody out. You say what they said. You don't agree. You don't disagree. You don't do either of those two things. So he laid everything out, 500 years, economic harm, war damages, violations of the fishing rights. I mean, he went on ad nauseum. When you're doing it, if you don't feel like you're laying it on thick, you're not laying it on thick enough. So he lays it on super thick, and a terrorist says, that's right. Those are the magic words. When somebody feels heard out, they say, that's right. And he goes dead silent on the phone. And the 10 million ransom disappeared in that moment. My guy says, let's talk again in a couple of days. He says, okay, they hang up. They never asked for money again. Now, what happens after that? They still got the hostage, right? Hot. We go through a couple more months back and forth again. We're answering everything with empathy. We're not arguing. We're just hearing them out. Our hostage walks away. The other side, it exhausts the other side. They run. they're driven by their emotional angst, and it takes away their emotional angst. And the emotional angst is their jet fuel. It's their rocket fuel. You take their fuel away from them. They don't have any more, you know, they're coming at you anymore. And in this instance, it took away so much of their energy that the hostage had the chance to just walk away. Hostage walks away. We fly him back to the U.S. I'm back in the Philippines a couple of weeks later on another case. I catch back up to the negotiator that I coached on the first kidnapping. He says, "You're not going to believe who called me on the phone." I'm like, "Okay, yeah, how am I supposed to know who calls you on the phone?" He says, "It was a terrorist." And no kidding, really. What did he say? He said, "Have you been promoted? You did a really good job. They should promote you." You know, it's somebody on the opposition feeling heard out and still and respecting you. It's another way of earning respect. Today, people are looking to be heard. They're just looking to be heard. And it's a very close relationship. It's like when a family member wants to be heard. You know, it's a cliche that people are yelling at each other over the holidays.
Right.
Because these are people we've been involved with for a long time. And they're not hearing us out. And if they don't hear us out, how can we collaborate? If you're not going to listen to me, how are we ever going to work together on anything? And that's the essence of what's behind the meat of the problem here. And whatever's left after that, we're never going to be able to deal with resolving issues until people feel heard.
That's a really interesting point, because we label these groups as terrorists, and you know, these people have the label of terrorist, where we're almost dehumanizing them. But you know, at the end of the day, we need to remember that they're people and they have feelings. And like you said, their emotional angst is, I guess, driving a lot of their actions and their behavior. And it directly applies, I think, to just about anybody that you deal with. I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like my children are terrorizing me. You know, so it's kind of the same psychology that, you know, they also, they want to be heard and they want to know that you understand what they want. You don't necessarily have to agree or give them what they're looking for. But so how do we define these mini negotiations, I guess, because what I'm hearing you say is that we're negotiating all the time. Every minute of the day, we're in some kind of a negotiation, whether it's with our family, with coworkers, and at the, you know, highest levels with terrorists.
Yeah, well, if the words "I want" are coming out of your mouth, you're in a negotiation. You know, "I want you to go to bed. I want to go to the movies. I want a vanilla latte frappuccino." You know, you're in a negotiation. If the words "I want" are coming out of your mouth, because there's compliance involved with the other side. You know, their actions. "I want a vanilla frappuccino." You know, the other person on the other side has to act on your behalf. They're not going to do it automatically. I got a message from a guy. This guy, actually, he told me, we met in person. We were at a conference speaking. He started this global phenomenon called secrets. He said, "Tell me your secrets anonymously. I will share them with the world." Somebody else is struggling with the same thing you're struggling with. It's going to help people to know they're not alone. So I'm like, cool, because I told them the most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. He says, "Yeah, let me tell you this story. I get a Starbucks coffee cup that's still in the wrapper to prove that the guy was working at Starbucks. And the note said, 'I give decaf to people who are mean to me.'"
That's terrible.
Well, then, you know, then, the most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in, right? And so then I told some other people, I was telling this guy, I knew there was a waiter. He says, "Yeah, man." He says, "When, you know how people ask for decaf at night after the dinner? Well, if they're mean to us, we give them regular coffee." So that, so you're in a negotiation all the time. If I want coffee after, I want decaf after my dinner, that if you were not a good customer, you're not going to get decaf in that coffee cup. So
might get even something else too.
yeah, who knows, right? A little salt, pepper, who knows? But yeah, we're negotiating all the time, and it's about how we treat people. And you know, another saying we live by, I'm gonna hit you with a lot of sayings, all right? So never be mean to somebody that could hurt you by doing nothing. And if you stop and think about that, you're like, wow. Everybody I talked to try to get collaboration out could hurt me by inaction. If they just failed to cooperate, they could hurt me by doing nothing. So those are negotiations. Now what's the flip side of that coin? The really cool flip side of that coin is everybody could help you if they felt like it. So just make them feel like it. Like me and my guys on my team, every hotel we walk into, we know a very specific approach other than asking directly for it, because that's the worst way to get something, just asking for it. We always get upgrades to suites for free, or if they don't got any suites, we get an upgrade to another one, or they move us to a more picturesque room. Or I rolled into this hotel in LA probably about 6-7 months ago. They were booked. And the dude, I could tell he felt bad he couldn't upgrade me. But he goes, hey, you know, my buddy runs a restaurant next door. I can get you a discount on the food. That's because he felt like helping me. And he felt like helping me. So he had to find some way to help me. I mean, people can help you if you make them feel like it and you give them a chance.
You see, though, I got to think about that, because you are a likable person, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, but you are. You know, you have a charisma. You know how to talk to people. You're friendly. You're likable. You know, and that comes through. How do people learn that? Because there, you know, there's a lot of people that have the completely, you know, opposite personality. They don't, you know, necessarily know how to maneuver that kind of persona.
I'm in the camp that almost everything is learned. I mean, you can't teach me how to be 7 feet tall. You can't teach me to be as big as a rock. But you know what the rock has learned to do, he learned. And it's just being willing to learn. How do you be likable? Just start by smiling. I mean, and some people got to practice smiling. Some people have to work at it. My daughter-in-law, the director, chief of marketing in my company, she is the most likable person you will ever meet. She's an animal. She's the type that her natural born type comes off very cold and very distant if she's just herself. She's highly analytical. She's really up in her head. But she's a learner, and analysts are good at learning. They tend to be really introspective as well. And she just noticed that people who smiled and laughed, other people got along with them. They didn't argue with them. They got stuff done. And smiling and laughing was a way to get stuff done. So she started trying it out. If you met her now, you'd be like, you are the most, you laugh, you're so much fun. And she is, but she's an assassin underneath too. So she learned how to be likable. You could learn this stuff.
This episode is brought to you by Ready Mask. A lot of us are looking to protect the health of our employees and our office guests, as well as ourselves. Ready Mask's new unique and innovative line of comfortable and strapless N95 masks are available on their website. That's readimask.com. Check them out and social distance in style. If you like our discussions and would like to support our efforts, be sure to subscribe on Patreon, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or YouTube. If you have an idea about a topic or know someone who would be a great guest, reach out on our website, amplifiedpodcast.com.
So how would you define some of the types of people that you encounter? Like, is there like a secret code to deciphering what somebody's personality would be right off the bat? You know, okay, I can put this person in this bucket and this is how I can relate to them or talk to them, or this is how they're going to interpret what I'm saying. Is there such a cheat sheet somewhere we can download?
Yeah, well, you know, it kind of is. It's a great question. I mean, there are basically three types, and there are survival types. Fight, flight, make friends. And these are from the caveman days when you know, we saw a saber-toothed tiger or something on the jungle path that came in and survived, either fought it, ran from it, or made friends with it. And the world splits up pretty evenly into those three types. I mean, we have a way of polling and testing people for that. And we've literally polled probably 10,000, tested 10,000 people globally and seen very consistently that the world will split up into fight, flight, make friends. So what are some examples of the types and how do you deal with them? Donald Trump is the aggressive, the assertive. I'm a natural born assertive. That's the fight type. You know, the people that are direct and a blunt, overly blunt, you know, attacking on a regular basis, like the conqueror. I mean, that's my natural born type. We're about a third of the planet. The very analytical type, the flight type. They see conflict as highly inefficient. You don't get anything done when you're fighting. Let's think about this. Let's come up with a plan. Let's put it into gear. Let's think about it a lot. They're very analytical. That's the flight type. Make friends, accommodators, gregarious. Love to interact, love people. You know, they're happy if they're interacting. They're not necessarily getting anything done, but they're interacting. So they're doing some great stuff because they're interacting and we're having a great time. Those are the three types. Now, also with polling those three types, we also ask them of the skills that we teach, how do you want to be talked with? How do you want somebody to approach you to make a great deal with you? And that's the labels. As it turns out, all three types love to be labeled. All three types love to have somebody look at them and say something effective. Sounds like you got a good reason for saying that. It sounds like you got a good reason for doing that. All three types love that. The three types sort of rear their ugly heads, if you will, at impasse. When we're misunderstanding one another, we're using the same words, but each of the three types is reacting vastly different to the same words or the same dynamic. Silence is a great example. Dead silence between two people. The assertive thinks, oh, you went silent because you want to hear more from me. So I'm going to talk some more because you shut up because you want to hear more. The analyst went silent because they want to think. And they're saying to themselves, geez, I wish this guy shut up. I need some time to think. And then the accommodator, they go silent when they're angry because to not talk is to stop the interaction, which is, that's the most important thing. So the analyst goes silent on the accommodator and the analyst goes, oh my God, they're furious. Oh my God. Oh my God. And they freak out the whole time the analyst was just trying to gather their thoughts. So that's one of the differences between the three types when you run into trouble.
Based on that, I'm an analyst.
You love to think, all right? Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, silence to me is a good thing. I don't mind it. So in your book, I think that's, I mean, it's just psychologically just fascinating to me, this topic. In your book, you talk a lot about, and I have a bunch of them. I would love our audience to kind of get just a little taste of what all of these things, how these things play out in a negotiation. But you talk a lot about ego, right? So what you just said, to me, what it sounds like is that when you're talking to someone and you want them to feel a certain way that you understand them, you kind of have to put your own feelings out, you know, the door. They can't come
right.
in. Talk to me about that. How does that work? Like, how do you even practice doing something like that?
Yeah, there are a couple of hacks. Being genuinely curious is a great way to get out of your own way. And there's like a whole bunch of other reasons to be genuinely curious. You're actually smarter when you're genuinely curious. You're in at least a mildly positive frame of mind. And Sean Acker is a Harvard psychologist that did this great TED talk called The Happiness Advantage, which everybody should watch. It's hysterical to start with. And secondly, Sean lays out this data. You're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. Now, I'm a very competitive person. If you're going to give me a hack to make me smarter, I want those tools. I want to get more done. So positive frame of mind. Curiosity is highly positive. You're smarter. Your brain works faster. you can take in more information. So to be genuinely curious, like, you know, like, if, you know, look at anybody, look at somebody wearing a Nazi uniform and ask yourself, I wonder what made him like that. And then ask him, you know, what made you like that? You know, what happened to you? How'd you get to this point where you felt like you had to wear this uniform? You'd be genuinely curious. Don't be judgmental. Don't be attacking. You'll change their psychological state in that moment. They will not know what to do with themselves because they're used to arguments. They're used to attacks. They're used to agreement or disagreement. And the application of empathy is neither. And it really catches people off guard, which causes, in many cases, instantaneous mind shifts. I mean, you could watch them. You watch them blink and shake their head like they're surprised. You're actually watching an electrical mind shift take place in their brain when they twitch and blink like that. And it's fun to put people through that because, you know, at that point in time, you got the upper hand. They had no idea you do, which is the other cool thing about it. But if you can get your ego out of your way, which was the challenge that you talked about at the very beginning, what you can accomplish is astonishing.
And that applies in, I think, a lot of business relationships. It applies in business partnerships. I mean, over time, I can't even tell you how many instances I've experienced where, you know, the idea is great, the business model is great, the strategy is great, the market is ripe for it, and we just can't get our egos out of the way, and we can't just put it aside and just get the work done and achieve the goal. I think it's just one of those things that, you know, you can't teach people. You can't tell them you're an egomaniac. You know, it just doesn't work.
No, you can't point it out to them. You got to get them to feel their way out of it. And so then the question with empathy is, how do I accelerate those feelings? And then when you learn a couple of, you learn about the wiring, like, we knew what we were doing in hostage negotiation, but we didn't have neuroscience. We couldn't explain why it works. With neuroscience now, we know so much more about the wiring. I can explain how it works. And then it accelerates success. I mean, you stop wasting time, which is the same as wasting money, not getting things done.
Talk to us a bit about tactical empathy. Like, what does that even mean? Because I read your book. I actually read it. I listened to it on Audible. I listened to you on TEDx, and I don't really understand exactly. I mean, I get empathy, but what is tactical empathy?
Yeah, empathy is a great missionary's tool, and it's a great mercenary's tool. So we put the word tactical in front of it for the following reason. Really, since about 2015-ish or so, people started publishing books on neuroscience explaining how the brain was wired, because they have machines to watch the electrical activity in the brain. I can put you in something called an fMRI, and I can watch the electrical activity in your brain, and I can map the components, and I can watch your thoughts in a form of electrical impulses go through your brain. So what did we learn from neuroscience? We learned the amygdala, which is kind of the command post or the central location or the trading desk, or thoughts flow through the amygdala. All of them do. The amygdala is 75% negative. We mapped it. We show people pictures that give them negative thoughts. Let me show you a picture of, you know, a puppy in the rain or something. You know, who knows? But we know the picture is going to cause a negative thought. And then we watch what parts of your brain light up. And we map it. You know, I'm saying we collectively. I wish I was a neuroscientist, but I'm privy to the publishing and the findings. So we map your brain. Your brain, and it makes sense. Survival wiring is negative wiring. The caveman had to survive by being basically pessimistic. Like, you know, I don't know, that long thing with the tongue flicking out of its mouth. If I'm a pessimist, I think it's going to hurt me. If I'm an optimist, I'm going to go over and pet it. Well, the optimist gets bit and he dies, and the pessimist lives. So, you know, we've inherited that wiring. Survival wiring is largely pessimistic. What's this have to do with tactical? Well, in the same brain science experiments, we learned that if we asked someone what they were feeling when they saw the picture of the puppy in the rain, whatever they said, whenever they self-labeled, whenever they simply called the negative emotion out, we see the electrical activity diminish every time. It's just as, it's as close to causation as you can get. And if you're a researcher, you know, the word causation is like saying Baltimore. There is no causation. It gets people crazy. But as close to causation as you could get, causing the negative thoughts to go away, just calling them out. And so tactically, if you're angry with me, and I know you're angry with me, instead of saying, I don't want you to be angry, I know from the neuroscience, if I say, seems like you're angry, your reaction will be, does it seem like I'm angry? Am I angry? And that kicks in that self-labeling process that diminishes the negative thought. And your anger will diminish to some degree, maybe a little, maybe a lot. Maybe I got to say it a bunch of times. We refer to this as the elephant in the room. Nobody ever made the elephant in the room go away by saying the elephant wasn't there, denying it was there. And we know that denial has such a negative impact that the next best thing was pretending it wasn't there. Well, at least it didn't make it worse. It never occurred to anybody to say, hey, there's an elephant in the room. And have the elephant get smaller. But in point of fact, when there's an elephant in the room, you say, hey, look, there's an elephant in the room. If you think I'm a jerk, I'm going to say, you think I'm a jerk. And that elephant will diminish every time. And that's the tactical application. Because we now know that negative thoughts are so much more dominating our thinking. If 75% of the real estate is for negative thoughts, that's got to be the problem.
Fascinating. If we have time, I would like to go over some more aspects of this, like body language, bargaining, mirroring, labeling. But if we don't, everybody can get this information from your book. I do want to jump to two of my favorite words. And I love them both for completely different reasons. And something that I've always said for years, you know, just coming from a marketing and sales and, you know, business background, I love hearing no, and I never really understood why. And eventually I read your book and I was like, holy cow. I mean, it makes complete sense to me. First of all, it never means no, as far as I was concerned. Back in the day, whenever I got a no, it just to me meant not right now, right? Or maybe you're not asking the right question. And I read your book, and everybody's got to read this book, especially if you're in marketing and sales. How do you define yes and no in a negotiation?
Well, we have a tendency to stay away from yes entirely because people are trying. Are so used to being led into the yes trap that they're leery of yes. You know, trying to get somebody to say yes has a tendency to actually disturb the relationship because they've been battered by the con artist, by the hustler, by, you know, sales has a very bad reputation, undeserved, because of the yes hucksters that are out there. Get somebody to say yes three times in a row, they have to say yes to the deal. And then they're not listening and just on and on and on around eliciting a yes. So the result of that is people get nervous as soon as you start to try to get them to say yes. Have you got a few minutes to talk? There isn't anybody I don't know that when her asked, have you got a few minutes to talk, doesn't tighten up on some level. Oh my God, how long is a few minutes? Where's this going? What do I let myself into? You know, what am I committing myself to if I say yes? That's the problem with yes. And so the flip side, you learn the different real meanings of no. No is not yet. No is not. I need more information. I'm not ready. No, I don't. I haven't felt hurt. No can really be yes, but there are conditions. But nobody's no battered. They feel they're no addicted because they feel safe when you say no. People say no and suddenly they're protected and they're sick. There's a chemical response when you feel protected and safe. You get a hit of serotonin. It makes you feel comfortable to say no. You get a hit of serotonin, you want to say no more because it makes you feel comfortable. Serotonin makes you feel comfortable and confident simultaneously. That's what happens when people say no. What's good about that? Now we'll keep talking with you. Now they're more open to sharing with you what are the conditions that need to be met so they can come to an agreement. Get out of yes, get to agreement, get to getting them to say that's right. So it looks like if I were to do this, this, and this, it would satisfy your problems and you could move forward. And if they say that's right, you're in a ball game. You're on the money. They feel heard. So they are more likely to say that after having said no, is the answer.
And what about yes? Are there different types of yeses? How do you distinguish them?
There's commitment, confirmation, and counterfeit. You know, people so often try to lead someone into the commitment yes through the confirmation yeses. You know, we talk about it in my book. Somebody stops you in the street and says, do you like water? Do you like clean water? Do you get thirsty? These are set up traps. This guy's gone someplace with this. Well, of course I like water. You're setting me up. Or, you know, some people say, you know, is it, I got an ex-girlfriend that used to ask me questions that was like, you know, isn't it possible that? Well, of course it's possible. I love it when somebody says, isn't it possible that? I said, yeah, well, it's possible that a case of Jack Daniels is going to fall out of a passing airplane and land intact on my bed, then I'm going to be able to drink it all. Yeah, it's possible, but I don't think it's going to happen. I love it when somebody, isn't it possible? I hate that question because it's a setup. The problem is that so many people have set us up that then the yes you get most likely is the counterfeit yes. Somebody's like, oh, I'm getting set up again. Let me say yes to see what this person has got. And the likelihood that they will agree has just been diminished because having felt set up, they feel less guilt about leading you down the path. You know, and real estate agents are really bad about this. I was at a real estate conference where real estate people were saying, well, buyers are liars. And I remember thinking to myself, buyers aren't liars. You try to set them up with yes so much that you condition them to give you the counterfeit yes. And because you're setting them up, you're blaming them for not being truthful with you when you were setting them up in the first place. So there's a little bit of a sequence here, and the counterfeit yes comes out an awful lot because whether you mean to or not, the other side feels set up by yes.
It's very interesting because the no makes the receiver feel safe.
Yeah.
And the yes makes the asker, I guess, feel good. Right? Yeah. So you have a complete communication breakdown in most negotiations because the negotiator wants to get a yes, but the negotiatee feels better when they say no. So now you're kind of stuck.
That's kind of crazy, right? But yeah, hearing yes is like getting a like on your Instagram post or on your Facebook page. You know, we dig it. You get a little hit of dopamine. It makes you feel really good hearing it. And you're hitting a problem exactly. Two people in the same conversation having a vastly different experience.
So speaking of Instagram and social media, so a lot of people are getting just crucified on social and all of these mini negotiations that they're having. What is some of your advice on that, on just the modern era virtual keyboard warriors having conversations? How do you handle something like that?
Yeah, you know, well, I'm supporting whenever I see people being supportive of one another. You know, I saw some pictures where police officers, I think in Fresno, California, took a knee with Black Lives Matter demonstrators. I put that out. There was a posting just the other day. It looked to be a very heated exchange between Black Lives Matter and white supremacists in England. And for whatever reason, one of the white guys collapsed. And the black guys picked him up and carried him to safety. So I'm amplifying, you know, all the collaboration that I see. And I take some heat for it. You know, like when I put the pictures of the police officers kneeling with the Black Lives Matter demonstrators, there were some postings, a minority. The vast majority of those postings get massive support. That's the thing that I find interesting. You know, don't be so sensitive to the criticism, because when you put something out that both sides can agree on, the support is overwhelming. And there are naysayers. And some people, it was widely circulated that the police officers that kneeled with the demonstrators turned around and beat them later. There is no evidence of that. None whatsoever. And I doubt it very strongly that that happened. But people said on social media that it did. I just ignored it. Or if somebody on my platform gets negative, I don't argue with them. I delete them. I'm not there to argue with anybody. I'm not obligated to amplify your negativity. I am amplifying empathy, compassion for the other side, and agreement. And at the end of the day, there's stuff we could all agree on. Like Black Lives Matter or Nazis both want better lives for their children. They want their kids to have a stable life, to live in a good house, to grow up in a safe place. There are things that could be talked about that both sides agree on. Probably 15 years ago, it was something called the Israeli-Palestinian Negotiation Project. The politicians were doing a horrible job, so the younger people on both sides got together to hear each other out. When they sat down, they said, let's agree that everybody wants a better life for their children. Nobody wanted to argue over that. So there's stuff that we can throw out there that the other side will not argue with. It's when you want to win the argument that you start to get into trouble.
And yeah, and I can see that most people want to win their argument. I was actually talking to a guest last week. Her name is Teresa Payton, and she used to work in cyber terrorism during the Bush administration. And she's been studying cyber terrorism for years. And she actually said something really interesting that her episode is coming out in 2 weeks that I think everybody needs to know, is that a lot of these people that are agitating on social media are apparently not even real people. They might be robots, or they might be programmed kind of responses just to get people to start fighting with each other and creating chaos. So it's always good to question everything as well. Like, is this person even a real person?
That's a good point. Yeah.
So how do you feel about some of the attention that law enforcement is getting? How can they use the skill sets that you teach in the modern era? Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, all kinds of changes for Leos and all kinds of changes just in general. What would be your suggestion on some of these tactical skill sets?
Law enforcement's got these tools and they're not using them. I mean, they need to get into the 21st century. And I'm very disappointed in my law enforcement brothers and sisters. Yeah, they have de-escalation skills. I think, you know, the system has gotten bogged down or locked up in a bit of a wrestling match in many police departments between poor leadership within the department and the unions. The unions are there to protect their members from bad leadership. And then they get into this downward spiral where all they do is obstruct one another. And they leave the cops out to dry. They hang the cops out to dry. I mean, being in law enforcement is equivalent to going through traumatic stress on a daily basis. And you're asking for if law enforcement leadership is not giving you the de-escalation, verbal de-escalation training, you're not getting, they're putting you out on the range constantly. You're not getting verbal de-escalation training. If they're teaching you physical tactics, you're not getting verbal de-escalation training. It's no wonder, because cops are human beings. And being a cop is a highly stressful job. And the law enforcement leadership and the unions are failing these guys, utterly failing these guys, and these gals. They're in some form of traumatic stress on a daily basis, and there are neurochemical changes that take place as people try to cope. Now, the good news is there is the only organ in the brain that's capable of regenerating itself in the body is the brain. The brain is a miraculous thing. There are people that have suffered traumatic brain injury that they were never supposed to walk again, and they put a sufficient amount of mental energy that they rewired their own brain and rebuilt the circuits. And it's called neuroplasticity. These police officers, men and women of all ethnicities that are undergoing this stress and are put in a position where the decision making is questionable, they can all be retrained. They can all be fixed. They need training from law enforcement leadership, and the law enforcement leadership is failing really decent men and women that are undergoing stressful events on a daily basis. That is their life. It's a tough job, and leadership, law enforcement leadership is utterly failing these people.
It's very unfortunate, and you know, it's on full display on the news all day, every day. It's I don't even know how anyone can understand what any of the law enforcement officers are going through unless you've gone through it. So I'm at a loss for that situation. But in general, how would you recommend people improve their relationships in, you know, every day between, you know, different groups that are having differences, between family members? I know you work with your family and your company, so that has to be an interesting daily interaction as well. Between coworkers, like how do we all kind of improve ourselves and become 2.0 versions of ourselves?
Emotional hygiene is making it a point of laughing to people or to be grateful on a regular basis. You know, I lived in LA for a couple of years. You know, Southern California gets this rap where everybody says, I'm so grateful. You know, and if you're not in Southern California, you make fun of the people in Southern California for being grateful all the time. Well, it's a hack. It's emotional and spiritual hygiene. And a great comparison is dental hygiene. You say to yourself, well, you know, I brushed my teeth last week. I don't have to brush them today. Or I brushed my teeth yesterday. I don't have to brush them today. I was grateful yesterday. Do I have to be grateful today? Do I got to be grateful every morning when I get out of bed? Is it really that important? I don't know. Do you brush your teeth every morning when you get out of bed? You know, there's a hygiene, spiritual hygiene issue here, because get back to what I said before, our survival mode is largely negative. You can overcome the negative wiring with the right amount of spiritual hygiene. Be grateful on a regular basis. Be curious on a regular basis. Daily, a couple times a day. Take care of yourself. And then consequently, now you begin to turn into version 2.0. You're a better person. You get more done as well. And my company, we get a massive amount of stuff done. I was on the phone yesterday with the woman that handles the vast majority of the scheduling and the implementation of the operations. We were laughing about me wearing a gorilla costume 40 years ago. So, you know, it's a business conversation, but I'm making sure that we laugh together.
I think those are really wise words, emotional and mental hygiene. That's actually, I think that's brilliant. So to wrap things up, what would be the four things that you could recommend that we do on a daily basis to practice gratitude, to practice emotional hygiene? Like how do you tactically do that? How do you practice that?
Sometime early in my morning. It may not be in the first 10 minutes. It's usually in at least the first hour. I sit down, I write the day and the date, and I write down three things that I'm grateful for. It takes 5 minutes max for me to sit there. So, and it doesn't have to be anything crazy. Like, I love pens. My thing is I love Visconti pens. I think they're cool. And I write with that pen, and nearly every day I'm grateful for the pen that's in my hand. You know, it's stupid little things. And be grateful for the simplest things, the socks that I have on. And how long does it take to write down three things that you're grateful for? I look over and I see a chair. I'm grateful that I got that chair. I feel the difference. I actually feel the difference. It sets me off. It's the same as how long does it take you to brush your teeth? Not that long. It sets the tone for the rest of the day. So I do the gratitude thing in the morning. And then another thing that I haven't done as much, but I have noticed when I do it on a regular basis, it really is a game changer. If you look for three things new each day that you never noticed before that you like, give yourself three likes instead of going on Facebook, just three new things that you like. You start noticing little things. And that being the quest for your day, you will be smarter all day long because you're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. You're also a little bit curious about your environment. You suddenly now have hacks that make you feel better as a human being, but that operationally, you will get more done. You will have more energy throughout the day. The circadian low that you hit in the middle of the afternoon that we hit because it's our biology will not be as heavy. You will not be as exhausted at the end of the day. It's an operationally effective thing to do. It's a mercenary skill. And it's a tiny little thing to move yourself forward through the day and to be happier and get more done. You want to be depressed so you get less done? So you have fewer things in your life? That's a downward spiral that you don't want. I want more things in my life. You know, I want another Visconti pen. I want something like that, right? So, you know, those are two things. And when you're talking to people, hear people out. One of my favorite stories, you mentioned my TED talk. This guy that we've taught that is using labeling, hearing people out in $100 million deals. I mean, literally, no joke. He worked for Amazon. He worked for Google. They were cutting massive, insanely huge deals by using these skills. He's being attacked by his sister at a family gathering. His sister's had too much to drink. And she's a primary caregiver for their dying father. She's under massive pressure, which is why when she attacks somebody in the family, you know, people don't want to fight back because they know the pressure she's under. She starts in on him. He realizes it's just my turn. He said, I want her to make her feel heard and to not dispute anything she said. He said she kept the attack up for an hour before she finally stopped. The next day, she sends him an email that says, thank you for being my big brother. Yesterday, I attacked you, and you showed me nothing but love. So hear people out. Just make people feel heard. Don't dispute what they say. You will be delighted at the impact that it has on them. And then, you know, I think those are three things. Go with that, and you'll have a lot of stuff you can work with.
I think that is... I mean, really wise words for everything that's going on today and all of the challenges that we're facing head on and we're trying to at least. And thank you. I mean, what an awesome, awesome topic. And I want to give you a virtual hug.
I'll take it.
Break the internet. but yeah, I mean, so informative. I'm so delighted and so grateful that you, gave us your time today. I'm so excited to, produce your episode and to get it out there. I think a lot of people will benefit, and absolutely everybody needs to read Crystal's book, Never Split the Difference. It's on Amazon. It's also on Audible. So Chris, how can our audience and how can people find you?
All right, so the best thing to do is to subscribe to our newsletter. We got this newsletter comes out every Tuesday morning, and it's complimentary. which means it's free. I had a friend that in the FBI that used to like to say, if it's free, I'll take three. So it's a good price. Comes out every Tuesday morning, and it is the gateway to the Black Swan Group. I mean, we help people no longer leave money on the table. We help people negotiate deals that will change their lives. And the best way to the Black Swan Group is through the newsletter. It takes you to the website. The best way to subscribe to the newsletter, we've got a text to sign up function. You text to the number 33777. That's 33777. And the message you send is Black Swan Method. Three words, Black Swan Method. Spaces between the words. It's not cap sensitive. You'll get a response back asking for your email. That'll sign you up. And the newsletter is concise and actionable. A lot of newsletters you get have seven articles. You don't know what to read. You get one article only in the newsletter. And it comes in on Tuesday mornings when you're ready to rock and roll. In a week, you've got Monday behind you. Gives you concise, actionable advice, relatively short piece. You can start getting better in your negotiations right away. So please subscribe to the newsletter.
I subscribe to your newsletter, and I see that you guys do webinars as well, I think, right?
People digest well at about an hour at a time, about once a week. We've done a lot of stuff online.
And the topics are very timely. They're very specific to things that are going on right now with COVID-19 and working from home and a lot of virtualization of things. And you're also very active on LinkedIn. So if anybody wants to connect with you, I think you go by your name. Your handle is Chris Voss on LinkedIn.
Yeah, and I'm on Instagram, the FBI Negotiator.
Yeah, that's right. I follow you on Instagram too. I stalk you everywhere. So,
thank you.
The production of the Amplified podcast has been brought to you by Social Fix Media. Social Fix is a transformational growth hacker agency focused on emerging technology platforms, video and podcast production, content marketing, and overall startup strategy. Social Fix has helped over 300 clients generate millions of dollars in revenue, fundraising, and profit. If you'd like help launching or growing your business, visit socialfix.com. If you like our discussions and would like to support our efforts, be sure to subscribe on Patreon, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or YouTube. If you have an idea about a topic or know someone who would be a great guest, reach out on our website, amplifiedpodcast.com. If you enjoyed this topic, make sure to tune in next week for our chat with Brian Seeley, cybersecurity expert, former U.S. Marine, ethical hacker, keynote speaker, on-air contributor to CNBC, Fox, NBC, ABC, The Dr. Oz Show, and TMZ, where we talk about human trafficking, ethical hacking, drug addiction, and the Epstein controversy. You won't want to miss the story of courage, perseverance, and never giving up.